Thank you very much, John. It's a real privilege to be able to be here this morning. I'm going to cover many of the themes that David did as well, but there are three particular topics that I really want to focus on. The first is the way that the Asian financial systems have integrated into the global financial system. The second is the considerable resilience of the Asian financial systems over the past 18 months. And the third is some general lessons that one might draw from this experience. So the first issue is Asian financial integration. If you look at the trade side, you see many of the countries of Asia highly integrated into the global trading system. And you can see this in this first chart here, which shows the ratio of exports and imports to GDP. It's quite high in Asia. But if you look at the financial side, the financial systems in Asia are not particularly well integrated into the global financial system. There are two aspects of this integration that I'd like to talk about. The first is the scale of the private gross border capital flows. If you look at the developed countries, you see very large cross-border private capital flows. So German citizens invest a lot in US assets and US citizens invest a lot in German assets. So there are very large two-way flows of capital. And you can see this in this next chart, which shows that over the past decade, these cross-border capital flows have averaged around 15% of GDP for the developed countries a year. They've fallen a lot recently as home bias strongly reasserted itself, but on average, there's been a lot of two-way flow of capital. But if you look at the Asian economies, the two-way flow of capital is much less. And here, the private gross border capital flows have only averaged around 2% of GDP over the past decade. So on the one hand, 15%, on the other hand, 2%. The second aspect of Asian financial integration is the role played by public sector entities. As David showed, for some years now, savings ratios in Asia have been considerably higher than the investment ratios. These, what some people call excess savings, have had to be, by necessity, channeled back to the developed countries of the world. But this hasn't occurred by the private sector in Asia buying foreign assets. It's occurred by the public sector in the form of the central bank buying assets in the developed countries. And as David pointed out, that's seen a very large rise in official reserve assets. A decade ago, those assets were around $500 billion. Today they're close to $4 trillion. So it's a tremendous change that's occurred there. Now, this model of financial integration with quite small private sector capital flows and the public sector playing a very big role in intermediating between Asian savers and the investors in the developed world has not been particularly conducive to the development of financial markets in Asia. And as a general proposition, these markets play a much less important role in allocating capital in Asia than they do in the other economies. There has, however, been progress, particularly since the late 1980s. One example of this is that the share of Asian currencies, excluding the yen, in global foreign exchange turnover has doubled, although it remains small. And if you look at measures of liquidity in bond and public debt markets, they've also improved in some countries. And you also see changes to the infrastructure supporting financial markets. So there has been progress. I think if you look forward, the recent strength in the Asian economies actually should help build or provide the basis for further financial market development in Asia. Because nothing hurts financial markets more than concerns about counterparty risk. And high country risk adds to counterparty risk concerns. So the strength that we've seen in the Asian economies in recent months, I think should give investors more confidence in counterparties in Asia, and ultimately that confidence is good for financial market development. And here you can see in this next chart the gradual improvement that's taken place over the last decade. It shows the average credit rating of the Asian sovereigns, and you can see a steady rise there for more than a decade, and I suspect that will continue. The second issue I would like to talk about is the resilience of the Asian financial systems. It's become quite commonplace to talk about recent events as the GFC, the global financial crisis. But I really think this is a misnomer, because it has not been a crisis in all the financial systems around the world. Rather, it's been a crisis in the financial systems of many of the advanced economies of the North Atlantic. To be sure, that crisis has had ramifications for the global economy, including the economies of Asia. But we have not seen a crisis in the financial systems in Asia. There have not been collapses of large financial institutions in Asia, and the Asian banks have not needed to be rescued by their governments. While the share prices of banks in Asia did fall last year, they've been more resilient over the last 6 months than the share prices of banks in the developed world. I think an obvious question to ask is why the Asian financial systems have been so resilient, especially, just like in the late 1990s crisis, there has been a very sharp reversal in bank capital flows into Asia, as you can see in this chart. It's very similar to what happened in the 1990s episode. Now, one obvious difference between what happened then and what's happening now is on this occasion, the sharp fall in bank capital flows into Asia has occurred not because of a crisis in the borrowing banks, but a crisis in the of confidence in the lending banks, particularly those in Europe. While the banks in Asia have had to adjust to the closure of international capital markets, there was not a loss of confidence in domestic counterparties, and the banks of the region have been able to continue to intermediate between savers and borrowers. And you can see this in this next chart, which shows credit growth in Asia, particularly in China, but not just in China, has held up at reasonable levels and certainly much better than in the advanced economies. I think part of this resilience is explained by the factors I talked about a few moments ago, that is the way that Asian financial markets, or the Asian financial systems have integrated into the global system, and the relatively limited reliance on markets as opposed to institutions. I think it's possible, although I wouldn't say inevitable, that if the private sector in Asia had been responsible for recycling the excess savings of the region to the rest of the world, then Asian entities would have ended up with more of the troubled assets they've so troubled everywhere else. The Asian central banks have predominantly bought assets of high credit quality, and even where they've suffered mark-to-market losses on those investments, these losses have no way threatened the stability of those institutions. I think another factor is the more traditional nature of the assets on the balance sheets of banks in the region. Because they basically hold loans, when the market price of risk rose and risk premiums spiked, these banks did not have to record very large mark-to-market losses. Instead, provisioning expenses have continued to be the main driver of profits of Asian banks, and the fairly quick recovery of a number of the Asian economies has meant these provisioning expenses have been contained. I think another example where you can see the lesser reliance on markets helping insulate the Asian financial systems is in the short-term money market. In a number of countries in the region, turnover in these markets is relatively limited at the best of times, and the central bank is actually a counterparty to many transactions in the market. The fact that the central bank plays this role and has an undisputed credit rating for domestic currency transactions meant that when risk aversion rose markedly in the global financial system, we did not see the same dislocations, the same uncertainty that we in Asian financial systems that we saw in the financial systems of the North Atlantic. A further factor that's obviously helped resilience is the large foreign reserves, which I talked about, and the fact that many countries in the region run current account surpluses. And there have also been quite significant improvements in financial regulation over the past decade. So, in short, the financial systems in Asia, with their less reliance on financial markets and more reliance on financial institutions, and the important role that the central banks have intermediated between Asian savings and the advanced economies, has contributed to the resilience of their financial systems. I think that's undeniable. It's clearly been an effective formula and it's worked. But I think it's also worth noting that Australia's financial system, with its much greater resilience on markets and its very extensive interconnections with the global system, has also been resilient over recent times. Financial institutions in Australia have remained profitable and they have high credit ratings. The government did have to offer a guarantee on banks' new wholesale funding when global capital markets closed for a time. But the severe dislocations that we've seen in the financial systems of North Atlantic countries have not occurred here. And like the banks in Asia, the Australian banks have been able to continue to intermediate between savers and borrowers in this country. I'd like to end off with thinking about some possible lessons from these experiences. The first of these is the importance of flexibility. As recent events have shown us, if we didn't already know, unexpected developments can occur very quickly and investors' attitudes to risk can change very quickly. Given these large uncertainties, particularly in financial markets, having this flexibility to respond to changing circumstances is crucial. In our own case, a critical part of this flexibility is the floating exchange rate. I think it's been a key stabilising influence for at least three decades now. In countries with higher trade shares than Australia's, it's arguable that the benefits from a freely floating exchange rate are less than in Australia's case. But more generally, low levels of public debt and credible monetary policy frameworks do provide policymakers with the flexibility to respond quickly and effectively to changing circumstances. And we've seen that both in Australia and in Asia. Flexible labour and product markets are also very important. In a number of these areas, the Asian countries rate quite highly, with their flexibility of markets being an important factor underpinning their dynamism of recent decades. The second lesson, I think, is about financial regulation. Again, as the experience of the North Atlantic financial systems reminds us, financial systems can get into trouble when regulatory arrangements don't keep pace with developments in the financial system. That experience reminds us that if countries are to live comfortably with extensive financial systems, with deep financial markets that are integrated into the global system, then appropriate regulatory arrangements are essential. And these arrangements need to cover financial institutions and they need to cover markets. But policy makers also need to take a holistic approach. They need to be concerned about growing risks in the system as a whole, as opposed to risks in just a single institution or a particular market. That's not an easy thing to do, but I don't think the task there is an impossible one. The third lesson is that the resilience of financial systems can be achieved in different ways. There's really no one-size-fits-all solution. Having said that, there are clearly benefits to be gained from international trade in capital and from the development of financial markets. Investors are able to have more diversified portfolios. Consumers are able to smooth consumption more effectively over time. Financial institutions are more likely to be responsive to the needs of savers and borrowers. And ultimately, the cost that society pays for financial intermediation is likely to be lower. But clearly, globalisation and the development of financial markets brings new risks. And these risks do need to be managed carefully. And countries will clearly differ on how they view the risk-return trade-off here. And these views are likely to change through time. A country's history is obviously important. So too is its openness to trade. Its level of per capita income is important, and so is the overall size of the economy. In Australia's case, few people would argue that a return to the financial environment of the 1970s, with its limited financial markets, a less flexible exchange rate, and less integration into the global financial system, would be the best way for us to proceed. Whatever approach is chosen, I think no one disputes the importance of the underlying goal here, having a strong, resilient financial system that it's able to support the ongoing expansion of the real economies. Over recent times, I think is within reason to conclude that both Australia and Asia have done much better here than many other countries around the world. Thank you.
Barry Marshall, UWA. I'm a medical doctor, so my question might be a bit naive, but should Australian companies be investing or doing international deals in US dollars, or is there some kind of an average kind of currency basket that you can buy? Because I understand that the West Australian government at the moment is a little bit strapped because the royalty stream comes in US dollars and it's dropped by 40%, what there is left of it. Thanks.
Well, I'm not going to provide advice on what currency one should borrow in. I think what's gone on in the banking industry is kind of an interesting example, though, because there the banks borrow in a whole range of different currencies, as Alex will probably talk about in more detail. But what they do is hedge it back into Australian dollars through the swaps market. And so I think that's a reasonable model for many companies, but it depends very much on the nature of your assets and your other liabilities. So I don't think you can make kind of some general statement that companies should be borrowing in one currency or another. It really depends upon the particular circumstances. But because we have developed financial markets, if you can find someone who wants to lend you and borrow in US dollars, but you don't want to take the currency risk, you can swap it back into Australian dollars, and that's one of the benefits of having these deep liquid markets that we do have. And the banks have taken advantage of that over many years.
I might take the prerogative of the chair and just ask one other question. It was raised earlier this morning about China and how important it is to the region and the growth that it's enjoying, largely off currently the fiscal stimulus that it put into its economy, which is extremely targeted and extremely effective. And the question is, how long can that remain effective, particularly if America and Europe struggle out of this recession? The simple question is, how decoupled do you think Asia, this region, has become from America, or is it still closely aligned, and will growth continue to be determined by what happens in North America?
I think at a business cycle frequency, Asia and the countries of the North Atlantic are still very closely integrated. The business cycles broadly move similarly. The issue, I think, is more important to us, though, is kind of in the trend growth sense, can the countries of Asia continue to grow at quite a strong pace when the Western countries grow quite weakly? Because I think that's the scenario, that's the central scenario that we're looking at. And in the last year, the countries of Asia have actually been able to grow pretty strongly, largely based on domestic demand that's been driven by fiscal stimulus. That's true. They obviously cannot keep doing that year after year. But I think there are reasonable prospects for strong domestic demand growth from consumption. As David said, the consumption ratios in Asia are very low. And with the right government policies, I don't see why they can't rise over time. Why should it be that the 3.5 billion people in Asia can't grow through domestic demand? I mean, the 200, 300 million people in America seem to be able to grow their economy through domestic demand. So why would it be that 3.5 billion people cannot have strong growth in their economy through domestic demand, particularly when I think people understand what's actually required? I mean, liberalisation of the services sector, further development of the financial sector, improvements in the social security safety net. I think the policymakers in the region understand that, and consumption shares are low. I think they'll gradually rise over time. It won't be continue to be driven through fiscal stimulus and high investment. Consumption in the region, I think, will grow. And so that gives me reasonable confidence that in the medium term, Asia can de-link at least some cent from the West.